sexuality so often engendered. Coming from Craiglin, it didn't surprise him a bit. He wondered if the man had had some cheap, culture-imitative surgery himself. It wasn't uncommon. It wasn't safe, either. Too often, such alterations were simply plumbing jobs, especially on males, and made no attempt to upgrade the heart and the rest of the circulatory system, at least to cope with the increased strain. In the culture, of course, that high performance was gene-affixed in. Such mimicking of this symptom of the culture's decadence had quite literally caused a lot of broken hearts. I suppose we'll hear about those wonderful drug glands next, Hawser thought.
Yeah, and they have those drug glands, Craiglin went on, eyes still unfocused, nodding to himself. Supposed to be able to take a hit of almost anything, any time they want, just by thinking about it. Secrete stuff that makes them high.
Craiglin stroked the flask he held.
You know they say you can't rape a culture woman.
He didn't seem to expect an answer. Hawser stayed silent. Craiglin nodded again.
Yeah, they've got class, those women. Not like some of the shit on this ship.
He shrugged and took another snort from the flask.
Still.
Hawser cleared his throat and leaned forward in his seat, not looking at Craiglin.
She's dead now, anyway, Hawser said, looking up.
Hmm?
Craiglin said absently, looking at the changer. The culture woman, Hawser said.
She's dead. Oh, yes.
Craiglin nodded, then cleared his throat and said,
So, what do you want to do now? I'm sort of expecting you to come along on this temple caper. I think you owe us that for the ride.
Oh, yeah, don't worry, Hawser said.
Good. After that, we'll see. If you shape up, you can stay. Otherwise, we'll drop you off somewhere you want, within reason, like they say. This operation should be no problem. Easy in, easy out.
Craiglin made a dipping, flying motion with his flattened hand as though it was the model of the cat which hung somewhere over Hawser's head.
Then we go to Vavach.
He took another gulp from the fumes in the sniff flask.
Don't suppose you play damage, hmm?
He brought the flask down, and Hawser looked into the predatory eyes through the thin mist rising from the flask's neck. He shook his head.
Not one of my vices. Never really got the chance to learn. Yeah, I guess not. It's the only game,
Craiglin nodded, apart from this. He smiled and glanced about, obviously meaning the ship, the people in it, and their occupation.
Well, Craiglin said, sitting up, I think I've already said welcome aboard, but you are welcome.
He leaned forward and tapped Hawser on the shoulder.
So long as you realise who's boss, huh?
He smiled widely.
It's your ship, Hawser said.
He drank what remained of the flask's contents and put it on a shelf beside a portrait holocube which showed Craiglin standing in his black suit, holding the same laser rifle which was mounted on the wall above.
I think we'll get on just fine, Hawser. You get to know the others and train up, and we'll knock the shit out of these monks. What you say?
The man winked at him again.
You bet,
Hawser said, standing and smiling. Craiglin opened the door for him.
And for my next trick, thought Hawser, as soon as he was out of the cabin and walking down to the mess, my impression of Captain Craiglin.
During the next few days, he indeed got to know the rest of the crew. He talked to those who wanted to talk, and he observed or carefully overheard things about those who didn't. Yalson was still his only friend, but he got on well enough with his roommate, Wubslin, though the stocky engineer was quiet, and when not eating or working, usually asleep. The Bratsilakins had apparently decided that Hawser probably wasn't against them, but they seemed to be reserving their opinion about whether he was for them until Marduin and the Temple of Light. Dorolo was the name of the religious woman who roomed with Yolson. She was plump, fair-skinned and fair-haired, and her huge ears curved down to join onto her cheeks. She spoke in a very high, squeaky voice, which she said was pretty low as far as she was concerned, and her eyes watered a lot. Her movements were fluttery and nervous. The oldest person in the company was Avager, a smallish, weather-beaten man with brown skin and little hair. He could do surprisingly supple things with his legs and arms, like clasp his hands behind his back and bring them over his head without letting go. He shared a cabin with a man named Jandralegeli, a tall, thin, middle-aged Mondladishian who wore the scar marks from his homeworld on his forehead with unrepentant pride and a look of perpetual disdain. He ignored Horza devoutly, but he also said he did this with every new recruit. Jandralijeli spent a lot of time keeping his old but well-maintained suit and laser rifle clean and sparkling. Gao and Ki Alsorifus were the two women who kept themselves so much to themselves and were alleged to do things when alone in their cabin, which seemed to annoy the less tolerant of the company males, that is, most of them. Both women were fairly young and had a rather poor grasp of moraine. Horza thought maybe that was all that kept them so isolated, but it turned out they were pretty shy anyway. They were of average height, medium build, and sharp-featured in grey skin, with eyes that were pools of black. Horza thought perhaps it was just as well they didn't look at people straight too often. With those eyes, it could be an unsettling experience. Mip was a fat, sombre man with jet-black skin. He could pilot the ship manually when Craiglin wasn't aboard and the company needed close support on the ground. Or he could take over at the shuttle controls. He was supposed to be a good shot, too, with a plasma cannon or rapid projectile rifle, but he was prone to binges, getting dangerously drunk on a variety of poisonous liquids he procured from the autogalley. Once or twice, Horza heard him throwing up in the next stall in the heads. Mip shared a cabin with another drunkard, called Nysin, who was more sociable and sang a lot. He had, or had convinced himself he had, something terrible to forget, and although he drank more steadily and regularly than Mip, sometimes, when he'd had a bit more than usual, he would go very quiet, and then start crying in great, sucking sobs. He was small and wiry, and Horza wondered where he put all the drink, and where all the tears came from inside his compact, shaved head. Perhaps there was some sort of short circuit between his throat and his tear ducts. Zbalik Odrai was the ship's self-styled computer ace. Because he and Mip together could, in theory, have overridden the fidelities Craiglin had programmed into the cat's non-sentient computer and then flown off in the ship, they were never allowed to stay on the craft together when Craiglin wasn't aboard. In fact, Odrai wasn't that well-versed in computers at all, as Horza discovered through a little close but apparently casual questioning. However, the tall, slightly hunchbacked man with the long, yellow-skinned face probably knew just about enough, Horza reckoned, to handle anything that went wrong with the ship's brains, which seemed to have been designed for durability rather than philosophical finesse. Zbalik Odrai roomed with Ravagamdol, who looked as though he came from the same place as Yalsin, judging from his skin and light fur, but he denied this. Yalsin was vague on the subject, and neither liked the other. Rava was another recluse. He had boarded off the tiny space around his top bunk and installed some small lights and an air fan. Sometimes he spent days at a time in this small space, going in with a container of water and coming out with another full of urine. Zbalik Odrai did his best to ignore his roommate and always vigorously denied blowing the smoke from the pungent Sifetresi weed which he smoked through the ventilation holes of Rava's tiny cubicle. The final cabin was shared by Lenipobra and Lam. Lenipobra was the youngster of the company, a gangly youth with a stutter and garish red hair. He had a tattooed tongue, which he was very proud of, and would display at every possible opportunity. The tattoo of a human female was, in every sense, crude. Lenipobra was the cat's best excuse for a medic, and was rarely seen without a small screen book, which contained one of the more up-to-date pan-human medical textbooks. He proudly showed this to Horza, including a few of the moving pages, one of which showed in vivid colour the basic techniques for treating deep laser burns in the most common forms of digestive tracts. Lenipobra thought it looked like great fun. Horza made a mental note to try even harder not to get shot in the Temple of Light. Lenipobra had very long and skinny arms and spent about a quarter of each day going about on all fours, though whether this was entirely natural to his species or mere affectation, Horza could not discover. Lam was rather below average height, but very muscular and dense-looking. He had double eyebrows and small horn grafts. The latter stuck out from his thinning but very dark hair above a face he usually did his best to make aggressive and threatening. He did comparatively little talking between operations, and when he did talk, it was usually about battles he had been in, people he had killed, weapons he had used, and so on. Lam considered himself second in command on the ship, despite Craiglin's policy of treating everybody else as equals. Every now and again, Lam would remind people not to give him any problems. He was well-armed and deadly, and his suit even had a nuclear device in it, which he said he would set off sooner than be captured. The inference he seemed to hope people would make was that if they upset him, he might just set off this fabled nuke in a fit of pique.
"What the hell are you looking at me for?" Lamb's voice said, in among the storm of static, as Hawser sat in the shuttle, shaking and rattling inside his too big suit.
Hawser realized he'd been looking across at the other man, who was directly opposite. He touched the mic button on his neck and said,
"Thinking about something else. I don't want you looking at me."
"Us all gotta look somewhere," Hawser said jokingly to the man in the matte black suit and grey visored helmet. The black suit made a gesture with the hand, not holding a laser rifle.
"Well, don't fucking look at me."
Hawser let his hand drop from his neck. He shook his head inside the suit helmet. It fitted so badly it didn't move on the outside. He stared at the section of fuselage above Lamb's head. They were going to attack the Temple of Light. Craiglin was at the controls of the shuttle, bringing it in low over the forests of Marduin, still covered in night, heading for the line of dawn breaking over the packed and steaming greenery. The plan was that the cat would come back in toward the planet with the sun very low behind it, using its effectors on any electronics the temple did have, and making as much noise and as many flashes as it could with its secondary lasers and a few blast bombs. While this diversion was absorbing any defensive capacity the priests might have, the shuttle would either head straight for the temple and let everybody off, or, if there was any hostile reaction, land in the forest on the night side of the temple and disgorge its small force of suited troops there. The company would then disperse, and, if they had the facility, use their AG to fly to the temple, or, as in Hawser's case, just crawl, creep, walk or run as best they could for the collection of low, slope-sided buildings and short towers which made up the Temple of Light. Hawser couldn't believe they were going in without some sort of reconnaissance, but Craiglin, when tackled on this point during the pre-op briefing in the hangar, had insisted that that might mean giving up the element of surprise. He had accurate maps of the place and a good battle plan. As long as everybody stuck to the plan, nothing would go wrong. The monks weren't total idiots, and the planet had been contacted and doubtless knew about the war going on around it. So, just in case the sect had hired any overhead observation, it was wiser not to attempt a look-see, which might give the game away. Anyway, temples didn't change much. Hawser and several of the others hadn't been very impressed with this reading of the situation, but there was nothing else they could do. So, here they all sat, sweating and nervous and being shaken up like the ingredients of a cocktail in this clapped-out shuttle, slamming into a potentially hostile atmosphere at hypersonic speeds. Hawser sighed and checked his rifle again. Like his antique armour, the rifle was old and unreliable. It had jammed twice when he tested it on the ship using dummy shells. Its magnetic propulsor seemed to work reasonably, but, judging by the erratic spread of the bullets, its rifling field was next to useless. The shells were big, at least 7mm caliber, and three times that long, and the gun could hold only 48 at a time and fire them no faster than 8 a second. Incredibly, the huge bullets weren't even explosive. They were solid lumps of metal, nothing else. To top it all, the weapon's sight was out. A red haze filled the small screen when it was turned on. Hawser sighed.
"We're about 300 meters above the trees now," Craiglin's voice said from the shuttle flight deck. "Doing about 1.5 seconds, the cat's just started its running. About another 2 minutes, I can see the dawn. Good luck, all."
The voice crackled and died in Hawser's helmet speaker. A few of the suited figures exchanged glances. Hawser looked over at Yolson, sitting on the other side of the shuttle about 3 meters away, but her visor was mirrored. He couldn't tell if she was looking at him or not. He wanted to say something to her, but didn't want to bother her over the open circuit in case she was concentrating, preparing herself. Beside Yolson, Doralo sat, her gloved hand making the circle of flame sign over the top of her helmet visor. Hawser tapped his hands on the old rifle and blew through his mouth at the mist of condensation forming on the top edge of his visor. It made it worse, just as he thought it might. Perhaps he should open his visor now that they were inside the planet's atmosphere. The shuttle shook suddenly as though it had clipped the top of a mountain. Everybody was thrown forward, straining their seat harnesses, and a couple of guns went sailing forward and up to clatter off the shuttle ceiling before slamming back to the deck. People grabbed for the guns, and Hawser closed his eyes. He wouldn't have been at all surprised if one of these enthusiasts had left their safety catch off. However, the guns were retrieved without mishap,
and people sat cradling them and looking about.
"What the hell was that?" the old man Avager said, and laughed nervously.
The shuttle began some hard manoeuvring, throwing first one half of the group on their backs, while the people on the other side were suspended by their seat webbing, then flipping in the other direction and reversing the postures. Grunts and curses came over the open channel into Hawser's helmet. The shuttle dipped, making Hawser's stomach feel empty, floating, then the craft steadied again.
"Bit of hostile fire,"
Craiglin's clipped tones announced, and all the suited heads started to look from side to side.
"What? Hostile fire?"
"I knew it."
"Uh-oh."
"Fuck.
Why did I think as soon as I heard those fateful words, easy in, easy out, that this was going," began Jandralajeli in a bored, knowing drawl, and it'd be cut off by Lam.
"Hostile fucking fire, that's all we need. Hostile fucking fire."
"They are gunned up," Lenny Pobre said.
"Shit, who isn't these days?" Yalson said.
"Chais Lor Harver, sweet lady, save us all," muttered Doralo,
speeding up the tracings of the circle over her visor.
"Shut the fuck up," Lam told her.
"Let's hope Mip can distract them without getting his ass blown off," Yalson said.
"Maybe we should call it off," Ravagandol said. "Think we ought to call it off? Do you think we should call it off? Does anybody?"
"No, yes, no,"
shouted three voices, almost in unison. Everybody looked at the three Bratzilakins. The two outer Bratzilakins turned their helmets to look at the one in the middle as the shuttle swooped again. The middle Bratzilakin's helmet turned briefly to each side.
"Oh, shit," a voice said over the open channel. "All right, no."
"I think maybe we should,"
Ravagandol's voice started again. Then Craiglin shouted,
"Here we go, everybody ready."
The shuttle braked hard, banking steeply one way then the other, shuddering once and dipping. It bounced and shook, and for a second Hawser thought they were crashing. But then the craft slid to a stop, and the rear doors jawed open. Hawser was on his feet, with the rest of them piling out of the shuttle and into the jungle. They were in a clearing. At its far end, a few branches and twigs were still tumbling from huge, heavy-looking trees where the shuttle had just seconds before torn through the edge of the forest canopy as it dipped in for the small area of level grassy ground. Hawser had time to see a couple of bright birds flying fast out of the trees nearby and caught a glimpse of a blue-pink sky. Then he was running with the others round the front of the shuttle where it still glowed dark red and vegetation beneath it smouldered and on into the jungle. A few of the company were using their AG, floating over the undergrowth between the moss-covered tree trunks, but hampered by creepers which hung like thick, flower-strewn ropes between the trees. So far, they still couldn't see the Temple of Light, but according to Craiglin, it was just ahead of them. Hawser looked round at the others on foot as they clambered over fallen trees, covered in moss and swept past creepers and suspended roots.
"Fuck dispersing, this is too hard going,"
it was Lam's voice. Hawser looked round and up and saw the black suit heading vertically for the green mass of foliage above them.
"Bastard," said a breathless voice.
"Yeah, bastard,"
Lenny Pobre agreed.
"Lam," Craiglin said, "you son of a bitch, don't break through up there. Spread out, disperse, damn it."
Then a shockwave Hawser could feel through his suit blasted over them all. Hawser hit the ground immediately and lay there. Another boom came through the hissing helmet speaker as it fed in the noise from outside.
"That was the cat going over." He didn't recognize the voice.
"You sure?"
"Somebody else. I saw it through the trees. It was the cat."
Hawser got up and started running again.
"Black bastard nearly took my fucking head off," Lam said.
There was light ahead of Hawser through the trunks and leaves. He heard some firing, the sharp crack of projectiles, the sucking whoop of lasers, and the snap-whoosh crash of plasma cannon. He ran to a small earth and shrub bank and threw himself down so that he could just see over the top. Sure enough, there was the Temple of Light, silhouetted against the dawn, all covered in vines and creepers and moss, with a few spires and towers sticking out above like angular tree trunks.
"There she is,"
Craiglin shouted. Hawser looked along the earth bank and saw a few of the company in the same prone position as he was.
"Wabslin, Avager,"
Craiglin shouted.
"Cover us with the plasmas. Nysin, you keep the micro on each side of the grounds, beyond as well. Everybody else, follow me."
More or less as one, they were off, over the tangled bank of mossy ground and bushes and down the other side, through light scrub and long cane-like grass, the stalks covered in clinging dark green moss.
The mixture of ground cover came up to about chest height and made the going difficult, but it would be reasonably easy to duck down out of a line of fire. Hawser waded through as best he could. Plasma bolts sang through the air above them, lighting the dim stretch of ground between them and the sloping temple wall. Distant fountains of earth and crashes he could feel through his feet told Hawser that Nysin, sober the last 2 days, was laying down a convincing and, more important, accurate fire pattern with the micro-howitzer.
"There's a little gunfire from the upper left level," the cool, unhurried voice of Jandra Lajeli said.
According to the plan, he was supposed to be hiding high in the forest canopy watching the temple.
"I'm hitting it now."
"Shit!"
somebody yelled suddenly. One of the women. Hawser could hear firing from ahead, though there were no flashes from the part of the temple he could see.
"Ha ha!"
Jandra Lajeli's smug voice came through the helmet speaker. "Got them." Hawser saw a puff of smoke over to the left of the temple. He was about halfway there by now, maybe closer. He could see some of the others not far away to his left and right, pushing and striding through the cane grass and bushes with their rifles held high to one shoulder. They were all gradually getting covered in the dark green moss, which Hawser supposed might be useful as camouflage, providing, of course, that it didn't turn out to be some horrible, previously undiscovered sentient killer moss. He told himself to stop being silly. Loud crashes in the shrubbery around him and smashed bits of cane and twigs fluttering past like nervous birds sent him diving for the ground. The earth beneath him shuddered. He rolled over and saw flames lick the mossy stalks above. A flickering patch of fire lay directly behind him.
"Hawser?"
a voice said. Yalson's.
"Okay," he said.
He got up to a crouch and started running through the grass, past bushes and young trees.
"We're coming in now,"
Yalson said. She was up in the trees too, along with Lam, Jandra Lajeli and Nysin. According to the plan, all except Nysin and Jandra Lajeli would now start moving through the air on AG toward the temple. Although the anti-gravity units on their suits gave them an extra dimension to work with, they could be something of a mixed blessing. While a figure in the air tended to be harder to hit than one on the ground, it also tended to attract a lot more fire. The only other person in the company with AG was Craiglin, but he said he preferred to use his for surprise or in emergencies, so he was still on the ground with the rest of them.
"I'm at the walls."
Hawser thought it was Odrai's voice.
"This looks all right. The walls are really easy. The moss makes it..."
Hawser's helmet speaker crackled. He wasn't sure if there was something wrong with his communicator or if something had happened to Odrai.
"Vamuel, I'm..."
"Are you useless?"
Voices clashed in Hawser's helmet. He kept wading through the cane grass and thumped the side of his helmet.
"Asshole!"
The helmet speaker buzzed, then went silent. Hawser swore and stopped, crouching down. He fumbled with the communicator controls at the side of the helmet, trying to coax the speaker back into life. His too big gloves hindered him. The speaker stayed silent. He cursed again and got to his feet, pushing through the scrub and long grass to the temple wall.
"Rejectiles inside!"
a voice yelled suddenly.
"This can't simple!"
He couldn't identify the voice, and the speaker went dead again immediately. He arrived at the base of the wall. It slanted out of the scrub at about 40 degrees and was covered in moss. Further along, two of the company were clambering up it, almost at the top, about 7 meters above. Hawser saw a flying figure weaving through the air and disappearing over the parapet. He started climbing. The clumsily large suit made it more difficult than it should have been, but he got to the top without falling and jumped down from the parapet onto a broad wall walk. A similar moss-covered wall sloped up to the next story. To Hawser's right, the wall turned a corner beneath a stubby tower. To his left, the wall walk seemingly disappeared into a blank cross wall. According to Craiglin's plan, Hawser was supposed to head along that way. There ought to be a door there. Hawser jogged along toward the blank wall. A helmet bobbed up from the side of the sloped wall. Hawser started to duck and swerve just in case, but first an arm waved from the same place, then both helmet and arm appeared, and he recognized the woman Gao. Hawser threw back the visor on his helmet as he ran, getting a faceful of jungle-scented marjoram air. He could hear some rattling projectile fire from inside the temple and the distant thud of an exploding micro-howitzer around. He ran up to a narrow entrance cut in the sloped wall, half covered by streamers of mossy growth. Gao was kneeling, gun ready, on the splintered remains of a heavy wooden door which had blocked the passageway beyond.
Horza knelt beside her and pointed at his helmet. "My communicator's out. What's been happening?" Gao touched a button on her wrist, and her suit PA said,
"Okay so far. No huts. They on towers."
She pointed up.
"Them no fly got in. They enemy got projectile guns only. Them fall back."
She nodded and kept glancing round through the doorway and into the dark passageway beyond. Horza nodded too. Gao tapped his arm.
"I tell Cracklin you go in, yes?"
"Yeah. Tell him my communicator's out, okay?"
"Yeah, sure. Zalin same trouble had. You be safe, okay?"
"Yeah. You be safe too," Horza said. He stood up and entered the temple, scuffing over splinters of wood and fragments of sandstone scattered over the moss by the door's demolition. The dark corridor branched three ways. He turned back to Gao and pointed. "Center corridor, correct?" The crouched figure silhouetted against the light of the door nodded and said,
"Yeah, sure. Go middle."
Horza set off. The corridor was covered in moss. Every few meters, dim yellow electric lights burned from the walls, casting murky pools of light which the dark moss seemed to absorb. Soft-walled, sponge-floored, the narrow passage made Horza shiver, though it wasn't cold. He checked that his gun was ready to fire. He could hear no other sound apart from his own breathing. He came to a T-junction in the corridor and took the right-hand branch. Some steps appeared, and he ran up them, stumbling once as his feet tried to run out of his oversized boots. He put his hand out and jarred his arm on the step. Some moss came off the step, and he caught a glimpse of something glinting underneath in the dull yellow light cast by the wall lights. He recovered his balance, shaking his jarred arm as he continued up the steps and wondering why the temple's builders had made the steps out of what looked like glass. At the top of the steps, he went down a short corridor, then up another flight of stairs, curving to the right and unlit. Considering its name, Horza thought, the temple was remarkably dark. He came out onto a small balcony. The monk's cloak was dark, the same colour as the moss, and Horza didn't see him until the pale face turned toward him, along with a gun. Horza threw himself to one side against the wall to his left and fired his gun from the hip at the same time. The monk's gun jerked upward and let loose a fusillade of rapid fire at the ceiling as he collapsed. The shots echoed round the dark, empty space beyond the small balcony. Horza squatted by the wall, gun pointed at the dark, crumpled figure only a couple of metres away. He raised his head and in the gloom saw what was left of the monk's face, then relaxed slightly. The man was dead. Horza levered himself away from the wall and knelt by the balcony balustrade. Now he could see a large hall in the dim light of the few small globes which protruded from its roof. The balcony was about halfway up and along one of the longer walls, and from what he could see, there was some sort of stage or altar at one end of the hall. The light was so dim he couldn't be sure, but he thought he saw shadowy figures on the floor of the hall moving. He wondered if it was the company, and tried to recall seeing other doors or corridors on his way to the balcony. He was supposed to be down there, on that level, on the floor of the hall. He cursed his useless communicator, and decided he would have to risk shouting down to the people in the hall. He leaned forward. Some shards of glass had fallen from the roof where it had been hit by the monk's gun, and his seated knee crunched on the debris. Before he could open his mouth to shout down into the hall, he heard noises from beneath, a high-pitched voice speaking a foreign language of squeaks and clicks. He went still, said nothing. It might just have been Dorolo's voice, he supposed, but why would she talk in anything other than Moraine? The voice called again. He thought he heard another, but then laser and projectile fire erupted briefly from the opposite end of the hall from the altar. He ducked, and in the lull heard something click behind him. He spun round, tightening his finger on the trigger, but there was nobody there. Instead, a small round thing, about the size of a child's clenched fist, wobbled on the top of the balustrade and plonked down onto the moss about a metre away. He kicked at it with his foot and dived across the body of the dead monk. The grenade detonated in midair, just under the balcony. Horza jumped up while the echoes were still cracking back from the altar. He leapt into the doorway at the far end of the balcony, putting out one hand and grabbing the soft corner of the wall as he went past, spinning himself round as he fell to his knees. He reached out and grabbed the dead monk's gun from the corpse's slack grip,
just as the balcony started to come away from the wall with a glassy, grinding noise. Hawser shoved himself back into the corridor behind him. The balcony tipped bodily away into the empty space of the hall in a dully glittering cloud of fragments and fell with a great shattering crash onto the floor below, taking the shadowy form of the dead monk fluttering with it. Hawser saw more of the shapes scatter in the darkness beneath him and fired down with the gun he had just acquired. Then he turned and looked down the corridor he was now in, wondering if there was some way down to the hall floor or even back outside. He checked the gun he had taken. It looked better than his own. He crouched and ran away from the doorway, looking over the hall, putting his old rifle over his shoulder. The dimly lit corridor curved right. Hawser straightened gradually as he left the doorway behind and stopped worrying about grenades. Then it all started to happen in the hall behind him. The first thing he knew was that his shadow was being thrown in front of him, flickering and dancing on the curving wall of the passage. Then a cacophony of noise and a stuttering burst of blast waves rocked him on his feet and assaulted his ears. He brought the helmet visor down quickly and crouched again as he turned back toward the hall and the bright flashes of light. Even through the helmet, he thought, he could hear screams mixed in with the gunfire and explosions. He ran back and threw himself down where he had been before, lying looking out into the hall. He put his head down as fast as he could and used his elbows to lever himself back the instant he realized what was happening. He wanted to run, but he lay where he was, stuck the dead monk's rifle round the corner of the doorway and sprayed fire in the general direction of the altar until the weapon stopped firing, keeping his helmet as far away from the doorway as possible, visor turned away. When that gun stopped, he threw it away and used his own until it jammed. He slid himself away after that and ran off down the corridor away from the opening of the hall. He didn't doubt that the rest of the company would be doing the same thing, those that could. What he had seen ought to have been incredible, but although he had looked only long enough for a single, hardly moving image to form on his retinas, he knew what he was seeing and what was happening. As he ran, he tried to work out why the hell the Temple of Light had been laser-proofed. When he came to a T-junction in the corridor, he stopped. He swung his rifle butt at the corner of the wall, through the moss, the metal connected, doubtless denting, but he felt something else give too. Using the weak light from the suit torch cells on either side of the visor, he looked at what lay underneath the moss. "Oh, God," he breathed to himself. He struck at another part of the wall and looked again. He remembered the glint of what he'd thought was glass under the moss on the stairs when he'd jarred his arm, and the crunching feeling under his knee on the balcony. He leaned against the soft wall, feeling sick. Nobody had gone to the extraordinary lengths of laser-proofing an entire temple, or even one large hall. It would have been horrendously expensive and surely unnecessary on a Stage 3 planet anyway. No. Probably the whole interior of the temple, he recalled the sandstone to which the outer door had been attached, had been built from blocks of crystal, and that was what was buried under all the moss. Hit it with a laser, and the moss would vaporize in an instant, leaving the interior surfaces of the crystal beneath to reflect the rest of that pulse and any subsequent shots falling on the same place. He looked again at the second place he'd struck with the gun, looked deep into the transparent surface beyond, and saw his own suit lights shining dully back at him from a mirrored boundary somewhere inside. He pushed himself away and ran down the right-hand branch of the corridor, past heavy wooden doors, then down some curved steps towards a splash of light. What he had seen in the hall was chaos, lit with lasers. A single glimpse, coinciding with several flashes, had burned an image into his eyes he thought he could still half see. At one end of the hall, on the altar, monks were crouched, guns firing, their own guns flashing with chemical explosive fire. Around them burst dark explosions of smoke as moss vaporized. At the other end of the hall, several of the company stood, or lay, or staggered, their own shadows huge on the wall behind them. They were loosing off with everything they had, rifles strobing pulses off the far wall, and they were being hit by their own shots, slamming back from the internal surfaces of crystal blocks they didn't even realize they were aiming at. At least two were blind already, judging by the way they were caught in poses of sightless blundering, arms out in front of them, guns firing from one hand. Hawser knew too well that his own suit, his visor especially, was not capable of stopping a laser hit, from either visible wavelength guns or X-rays. All he could do was get his head out of the way and loose off with what projectiles he had, hoping to get a few of the priests or their guards. He had probably been lucky he hadn't been hit, even in the brief length of time he'd looked into the hole. Now, all he could do was get out. He tried shouting into the helmet mic, but the communicator was dead. His voice sounded hollow in the suit, and he couldn't hear himself through the ear speaker. He saw another shadowy shape ahead, a dim silhouette crouched low against the wall in the pool of daylight, coming from another corridor. Hawser threw himself into a doorway. The figure didn't move. He tried his rifle. Its knocks on the crystal walls seemed to have unjammed it. A burst of fire made the figure collapse slackly to the floor. Hawser stepped out of the doorway and walked to it. It was another monk, dead hand gripped round a pistol. His white face was visible in the light which came down another passageway. On the wall behind the monk, there were the pockmarks of burned-off moss. Clear, undamaged crystal showed through beneath. As well as the holes produced by Hawser's burst of fire, the monk's tunic, now seeping with bright red blood, was covered with laser burns. Hawser stuck his head round the corner, looking into the light. Against the morning glow, framed in a slanting doorway, a suited form lay on the mossy floor, gun extended at the end of one hand so that it pointed down the passageway toward Hawser. A heavy door lay at an angle behind, just hanging by one twisted hinge. It's Gao, Hawser thought. Then he looked at the door again, thinking it looked wrong somehow. The door and the walls leading to it were scarred with laser burns. He went up the corridor to the fallen figure and rolled it over so that he could see the face. His head swam for a second as he looked. It wasn't Gao. It was her friend, Ki Al-Sorifus, who had died here. Her blackened, cracked face stared out, dry-eyed, through the still clear visor of her helmet. He looked at the door and at the corridor. Of course, he was in another part of the temple. Same situation, but a different set of passageways, and a different person. The woman's suit was holed centimetres deep in a few places. The smell of burned flesh leaked into Hawser's ill-fitting suit, making him gag. He stood up, took Ki Al-Sorifus's laser, stepped over the slanted door, and went out onto the wall walk. He ran along it, round a corner, ducking once as a micro-howitzer shell landed too close to the temple's sloping walls and sent up a shower of flashing crystal fragments and ruddy chunks of sandstone. The plasma cannons were still firing from the forest too, but Hawser couldn't see any flying figures. He was looking for them when he suddenly sensed the suit to one side of him, standing in the angle of the wall. He stopped, recognizing Gao's suit, and stood about 3 meters from her while she looked at him. She pushed the visor on her helmet up slowly, her grey face and black, pit-like eyes fixed on the laser rifle he was carrying. The look on her face made him wish he had checked the gun was still switched on. He looked down at the gun in his hand, then at the woman who was still staring at it. He was going to explain.
She killed, yeah?
The woman's voice sounded flat. She seemed to sigh. Hawser drew in a breath, was about to start talking again, but Gao spoke in the same monotone.
I thought I hear she.
Suddenly, she brought her gun hand up, flashing in the blue and pink of the morning sky. Hawser saw what she was doing and started forward, reaching out instantly with one hand, even though he knew he was too far away and too late to do anything. Don't! He had time to shout. But the gun was already in the woman's mouth, and an instant later, as Hawser started to duck and his eyes closed instinctively, the back of Gao's helmet blew out in a single pulse of unseen light, throwing a sudden red cloud over the mossy wall behind. Hawser sat down on his haunches, hands closed round the gun barrel in front of him, eyes staring out at the distant jungle.
What a mess, he thought. What a fucking obscene, stupid mess.
He hadn't been thinking of what Gao had just done to herself, but he looked round at the red stain on the angled wall and the collapsed shape of Gao's suit, and thought it again. He was about to start back down the outer wall of the temple when something moved in the air above him. He turned and saw Yalsin landing on the wall walk. She looked at Gao's body once, then they exchanged what they both knew of the situation, what she had heard over the open communicator channel, what Hawser had seen in the hall.
and they decided they would stay put until some of the others came out, or they gave up hope. According to Yalson, only Ravagandol and Sabalik Odrai were definitely dead after the firefight in the hall. But all three Bratzilakins had been there too, and nobody had heard anything from them after the open channel had become intelligible again, and most of the screaming had stopped. Craiglin was alive and well, but lost. Doralo lost too, sitting crying, maybe blinded, and Lenipobra, against all advice and Craiglin's orders, had entered the temple through a roof door and was heading down to try to rescue anybody he could, using only a small projectile pistol he'd been carrying. Yolson and Horza sat back to back on the wall walk, Yolson keeping the changer informed on how things were going in the temple. Lam flew overhead, heading for the jungle where he took one of the plasma cannons from the protesting Wubslin. He'd just landed nearby when Lenipobra announced proudly he had found Doralo, and Craiglin reported he could see daylight. There was still no sound from the Bratzilakins. Craiglin appeared round a corner of the wall walk. Lenipobra leapt into view, clutching Doralo to his suit and bounding down over the walls in a series of great, slow jumps as his AG struggled to lift both him and the woman. They set off back to the shuttle. Jandra Ligeli could see movement on the road beyond the temple, and there was sniper fire coming from the jungle on that side. Lam wanted to tear into the temple with a plasma cannon and vaporize a few monks, but Craiglin ordered the retreat. Lam threw the plasma gun down and sailed off toward the shuttle alone, swearing loudly over the open channel, on which Yalson was still trying to call the Bratzilakins. They waded through the tall cane grass and bushes under the whooshing trails of plasma bolts as Jandra Ligeli gave them cover. They had to duck occasionally. A small-bore projectile fire tore through the greenery around them. They sprawled in the hangar of the clear air turbulence, beside the still-warm shuttle, as it clicked and creaked, cooling down again after its high-speed climb through the atmosphere. Nobody wanted to talk. They just sat or lay on the deck, some with their backs against the side of the warm shuttle. Those who had been inside the temple were the most obviously affected. But even the others, who had only heard the mayhem over their suit communicators, seemed in a state of mild shock. Helmets and guns lay scattered about them. "Temple of Light," Jandra Ligeli said eventually, and gave what sounded like a mixture of laugh and snort. "Temple of fucking Light," Lam agreed.
"Mip," Craiglin said in a tired voice to his helmet. "Any signals from the Bratzilakins?"
Mip, still on the cat's small bridge, reported that there was nothing.
"We ought to bomb that place to fuck," Lam said. "Nuke the bastards."
Nobody replied. Yalson got up slowly and left the hangar, walking tiredly up the steps to the upper deck, helmet dangling from one arm, gun from the other, her head down.
"I'm afraid we've lost that radar."
Wubslin closed an inspection hatch and rolled out from underneath the nose of the shuttle.
"That first bit of hostile fire."
His voice trailed off.
"At least nobody's injured,"
Nysin said. He looked at Doralo.
"Your eyes better?"
The woman nodded, but kept her eyes closed. Nysin nodded too.
"Actually worse when people are injured. We were lucky."
He dug into a small pack on the front of his suit and produced a little metal container. He sucked at a nipple at the top and grimaced, shaking his head.
"Yeah, we were lucky. And it was fairly quick for them, too."
He nodded to himself, not looking at anybody, not caring that nobody seemed to be listening to him.
"See how everybody we've lost all shared the same. I mean, they went in pairs. Or threes. Huh?"
He took another slug and shook his head. Doralo was nearby. She reached over and held out her hand. Nysin looked at her in surprise, then handed the small flask to her. She took a swig and passed it back. Nysin looked around, but no one else wanted any. Horza sat and said nothing. He was staring at the cold lights of the hangar, trying not to see the scene he had witnessed in the hall of the dark temple. The clear air turbulence broke orbit on fusion drive and headed for the outer edge of Marduin's gravity well, where it could engage its warp motors. It didn't pick up any signals from the Bratzilakins, and it didn't bomb the Temple of Light. It set a course for the Vavach orbital. From radio transmissions they'd picked up from the planet, they worked out what had happened to the place, what had caused the monks and priests in the temple to be so well armed. Two nation-states on the world of Majuin were at war, and the temple was near the frontier between the two countries, constantly ready for attack. One of the states was vaguely socialist, the other was religiously inspired. The priests in the Temple of Light representing one sect of that militant faith. The war was partly caused by the greater galactic conflict taking place around it, as well as being a tiny and approximate image of it. It was that reflection, Horza realized, which had killed the members of the company, as much as any bounced laser flash. Horza wasn't sure how he would sleep that night. He lay awake for a few hours, listening to Wubslin having quiet nightmares. Then the cabin door was tapped lightly. Yalson came in and sat on Horza's bunk. She put her head on his shoulder, and they held each other. After a while, she took his hand and led him quietly down the companionway, away from the mess, where a splash of light and distant music witnessed that the unsleeping Kraiklin was unwinding with a drug flask and a holosound tape, down to the cabin which had been Gao's and Ki Alsorifus's. In the darkness of the cabin, on a small bed full of strange scents and new textures, they performed the same old act. Theirs, they both knew, an almost inevitably barren cross-matching of species and cultures thousands of light-years apart. Then they slept. State of Play 1. Fal and Gistra watched the shadows of the clouds move on the distant plain, 10 kilometres away, horizontally, and one vertically, and then, with a sigh, lifted her gaze to the line of snow-capped mountains on the far side of the open grassland. The mountain range was fully 30 kilometres from her eyes, but the peaks were sharp and distinct in the thin air, which they invaded with their rock and brilliant icy whiteness. Even at that distance, through that much atmosphere, their glare startled the eye. She turned away, walking along the broad flagstones of the lodge terrace with a stiff-legged gait unsuited to her lack of years. The trellis work above her head was covered in bright red and white flowers and cast a regular pattern of shadows over the terrace beneath. She walked through light and shade, her hair dim then shining gold in turn as each halting step moved her from shadow to sunlight. The gunmetal bulk of the drone called Jace appeared at the far end of the terrace, out of the lodge itself. Fal smiled when she saw it and sat down on a stone bench jutting out from the low wall which separated terrace from view. They were high up, but it was a hot and windless day. She wiped a little sweat from her forehead as the old drone floated along the terrace toward her, the slanting lines of sunlight passing over its body in a steady rhythm. The drone settled on the stones beside the bench, its broad, flat top about level with the crown of the girl's head.
"Isn't it a lovely day, Jace?" Fal said, looking back at the distant mountains again.
"It is," Jace said.
The drone had an unusually deep and full-toned voice and made the most of it. For 1,000 years or more, culture drones had had aura fields which coloured according to their mood, their equivalent of facial expression and body language. But Jace was old, made long before aura fields were thought of, and had refused to be refitted to accommodate them. It preferred either to rely on its voice to express what it felt, or to remain inscrutable.
"Damn."
Fal shook her head, looking at the faraway snow.
"I wish I was climbing."
She made a clicking noise with her mouth and looked down at her right leg, which stuck straight out in front of her. She had broken the leg 8 days before while climbing in the mountains on the other side of the plain. Now it was splinted up with a fine tracery of field strands concealed beneath fashionably tight trousers. Jace ought, she thought, to have taken this as an excuse to lecture her again on the advisability of only climbing with a floater harness, or with a rescue drone nearby, or at the very least on not climbing alone. But the old machine said nothing. She looked at it, her tanned face shining in the light.
"So, Jace, what have you got for me? Business?"
"I'm afraid so."
Fal settled herself as comfortably as she could on the stone bench and crossed her arms. Jace stretched out a short force field from its casing to support the awkward-looking outstretched leg, though it knew that the splint's own fields were taking all the strain.
"Spit it out," Fal said.
You may recall an item from the Daily Synopsis 18 days ago about one of our spacecraft, which was cobbled together by a factory vessel in the volume of space inside from the Sullen Gulf. The factory craft had to destruct, and later so did the ship it made.
I remember, said Fowl, who forgot little about anything and nothing at all from a Daily Synopsis. It was a mongrel, because the factory was just trying to get a GSV mined out of the way.
Well, Jace said, its voice a little weary, we have a problem with that.
Fowl smiled.
The culture, there could be no doubt, relied profoundly on its machines for both its strategy and tactics in the war it was now engaged in. Indeed, a case could be made for holding that the culture was its machines, that they represented it at a more fundamental level than did any single human or group of humans within the society. The mines that the culture's factory craft, safe orbitals and larger GSVs, were now producing were some of the most sophisticated collections of matter in the galaxy. They were so intelligent that no human was capable of understanding just how smart they were, and the machines themselves were incapable of describing it to such a limited form of life. From those mental colossi, down through the more ordinary but still sentient machines and the smart but ultimately mechanistic and predictable computers, right down to the smallest circuit in a micro-missile hardly more intelligent than a fly, the culture had placed its bets, long before the Adiran War had been envisaged, on the machine rather than the human brain. This was because the culture saw itself as being a self-consciously rational society, and machines, even sentient ones, were more capable of achieving this desired state as well as more efficient at using it once they had. That was good enough for the culture. Besides, it left the humans in the culture free to take care of the things that really mattered in life, such as sports, games, romance, studying dead languages, barbarian societies, and impossible problems and climbing high mountains without the aid of a safety harness. A hostile reading of such a situation might lead to the idea that the discovery by the culture's minds that some humans were actually capable of matching and occasionally beating their record for accurately assessing a given set of facts would lead to a machine indignation and blown circuits. But this was not the case. It fascinated those minds that such a puny and chaotic collection of mental faculties could, by some sleight of neuron, produce an answer to a problem which was as good as theirs. There was an explanation, of course, and it perhaps had something to do with patterns of cause and effect, which even the most godlike power of the minds had difficulty trying to fathom. It also had quite a lot to do with sheer weight of numbers. There were in excess of 18 trillion people in the culture, just about every one of them well-nourished, extensively educated and mentally alert, and only 30 or 40 of them had this unusual ability to forecast and assess on a par with a well-informed mind, of which there were already many hundreds of thousands. It was not impossible that this was pure luck. Toss 18 trillion coins in the air for a while, and a few of them are going to keep landing the same side up for a long, long time. Fowl N'Gistra was a culture referrer, one of those 30, maybe 40, out of the 18 trillion, who could give you an intuitive idea of what was going to happen, or tell you why she thought that something which had happened the way it did, and almost certainly turn out right every time. She was being handed problems and ideas constantly, being both used and assessed herself. Nothing she said or did went unrecorded. Nothing she experienced went unnoticed. She did insist, however, that when she was climbing, alone or with friends, she must be left to her own devices and not watched by the cultures. She would take a pocket terminal with her to record everything, but she would not have a real-time link with any part of the mind network on the plate she lived on. Because of that insistence, she had lain in the snow with a shattered leg for a day and a night before a search party had discovered her. The drone, Jace, started to give her the details of the flight of the nameless ship from its mothercraft, of its interception and self-destruction. Fowl had turned her head, though, and was only half listening. Her eyes and mind were on the distant, snowy slopes, where she hoped she would be climbing again in a few days' time, once these stupid bones in her leg had thoroughly healed. The mountains were beautiful. There were other mountains on the upslope side of the lodge terrace, reaching into the clear blue sky, but they were tame stuff indeed compared to those sharp, rearing peaks across the plain. She knew that was why they had put her in this lodge. They hoped she would climb those nearer mountains rather than take the trouble to hop into a flyer and head over the plain. It was a silly idea, though.
They had to let her see the mountains or she wouldn't be herself. And as long as she could see them, she just had to climb them. Idiots. On a planet, she thought, you wouldn't be able to see them so well. You wouldn't be able to see the lower foothills, the way the mountains rise and the plain just so.
The lodge, the terrace, the mountains and the plain were on an orbital. Humans had built this place, or at least built the machines that built the machines that, well, you could go on and on. The plate of the orbital was almost perfectly flat. In fact, vertically it was slightly concave, but as the internal diameter of the completed orbital, properly formed only once all the individual plates had been joined up and the last dividing wall was removed, would measure over 3 million kilometres. The curvature was a great deal less than on the convex surface of any human habitable globe. So from Fal's raised vantage point, she could see right to the base of the distant mountains. Fal thought it must be very strange to live on a planet and have to look over a curve so that, for example, you would see the top of a sea ship appear over the horizon before the rest of it. She was suddenly aware that she was thinking about planets because of something Jace had just said. She turned round and looked earnestly at the dark grey machine, playing back her short-term memory to recall exactly what it had just said. This mind went underneath the planet, in hyperspace, she said, then warped inside.
That was what it said it was trying to do when it sent the coded message in its destruct pattern. As the planet is still there, it must have succeeded. Had it failed, at least 0.5% of its mass would have reacted with the planet's own material, as though it was antimatter.
I see. Fal scratched at one cheek with a finger. I thought that wasn't supposed to be possible.
Her voice contained the question. She looked at Jace. What? It said.
Doing.
She scowled at not being immediately understood and waved one hand impatiently.
Doing what it did. Going under something so big in hyperspace and then bouncing over. I was told even we couldn't do that.
So was the mind in question, but it was desperate.
The General War Council itself decided that we should try to duplicate the feat using a similar mind and a spare planet.
What happened? Fal asked, grinning at the idea of a spare planet.
No mind would even consider the idea. Far too dangerous. Even the eligible ones on the War Council demurred.
Fal laughed, gazing up at the red and white flowers curled round the trellis work overhead. Jace, which deep down was a hopeless romantic, thought her laughter sounded like the tinkling of mountain streams and always recorded her laughs for itself, even when they were snorts or guffaws, even when she was being rude and it was a dirty laugh. Jace knew a machine, even a sentient one, could not die of shame, but it also knew that it would do just that if Fal ever guessed any of this. Fal stopped laughing. She said,
What does this thing actually look like? I mean, you never see them by themselves. They're always in something, a ship or whatever. And how did it... What did it use to warp with?
Externally, Jace said in its usual calm, measured tones, it is an ellipsoid. Fields up, it looks like a very small ship. It's about 10 meters long and 2.5 in diameter. Internally, it's made up of millions of components, but the most important ones are the thinking and memory parts of the mind proper. Those are what make it so heavy, because they're so dense. It weighs nearly 15,000 tons. It is fitted with its own power, of course, and several field generators, any of which could be pressed into service as emergency motors, and indeed are designed with this in mind. Only the outer envelope is constantly in real space. The rest, all the thinking parts anyway, stay in hyperspace. Assuming, as we must, that the mind did what it said it was going to do, there is only one possible way it could have accomplished the task, given that it does not have a warp motor or displacer.
Jace paused as Fal sat forward, her elbows on her knees, her hands clenched under her chin. It saw her shifting her weight on her backside and a tiny grimace appear fleetingly on her face. Jace decided she was getting uncomfortable on the hard stone bench and ordered one of the lodge drones to bring some cushions. The mind does have an internal warping unit, but it is supposed to be used only to expand microscopic volumes of the memory so that there is more space around the sections of information, in the form of third-level elementary particle spirals, which it wants to change. The normal volume limit on that warping unit is less than a cubic millimetre. Somehow, the ship mind jury-rigged it so that it would encompass its entire body and let it appear within the planet's surface,
A clear airspace would be the logical place to go for, and the tunnels of the command system seem an obvious choice. That is where it said it would head for.
Right, Fal said, nodding. Okay. Now, what do... Oh.
A small drone carrying two large cushions appeared at her side.
Hmm. Thanks, Fal said,
levering herself up with one hand and placing one cushion beneath her, the other at her back. The small drone floated off to the lodge again. Fal settled herself.
Did you ask for these, Jace? She asked.
Not me, Jace lied, secretly pleased.
What were you going to ask?
These tunnels, Fal said,
leaning forward more comfortably this time.
This command system. What is it?
Briefly, it consists of a winding paired loop of 22-meter diameter tunnels buried 5 kilometers deep. The whole system is several hundred kilometers in length. The trains were designed to be the wartime mobile command centers of a state which once existed on the planet, when it was at the intermediate sophisticated stage 3 phase. State-of-the-art weaponry at the time was the fusion bomb, delivered by a transplanetary guided rocket. The command system was designed to...
Yes, Fal waved her hand quickly. Protect, keep mobile so they couldn't be blown up, right?
Yes.
What sort of rock cover did they have?
Granite, Jace said.
Batholithic?
Just a second, Jace said,